This is Talk Is Cheap on KBWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. All right, so this is the Q&A from the October presentation of Madeline Lane McKinney's book on called Solidarity with Children about the family abolition movement, sponsored by the Rohr Center and the U of O Gender Studies program. And yeah, you'll hear some kids in there laughing and crying. I tried to lower the crying, but it's good to hear kids laughing. So I just thought it kind of interesting. And so what I do, you know, is I go and record things that you can't find. Usually you can't find anywhere else. And but I get to make some commentary from time to time. So my take on this, I know nothing. I've studied very little of the family abolition movement or the abolition movements in general. But I'm very interested. I'm abolition curious. And so I go to these whenever I can, because I think we need to, anybody that's doing anything, what you're going to find on here is I'm giving you people that are at least doing something, even if it's minor vandalism, because if poverty isn't vandalism, I don't know what is. But I try to give you people that are doing something, whether I agree with them or not. And I've done this for now 30, 40 years. I've been doing this. And so I try to learn something myself. So, you know, I'll just tell you my own experience, too, is my sister dated a black man when she was my older sister. And my father, this is the time of Archie Bunker in the 70s. And my father was going to throw her out of the house, and my mother put a stop to it. And my mother stopped him from paddling us and wasn't into corporal punishment and things like that. I can see where the family, what they're saying is the family is crucial, and the family has basically facilitated capitalism and patriarchy a lot of times. And let's face it, you know, the Native Americans, my understanding is they the whole village raised a child. So there was much less, and you didn't get up and do a 9-to-5 every day, you know, so there was much less child abuse in those societies. I mean, of course, they would kill you in those societies if you did do child abuse, but there was no real opportunity for child abuse because you're raised by everyone in the village, is my understanding of that anyway. So, but I am fairly an expert on permaculture, and so there is a permaculture example for this. This is in Christopher Alexander's book, A Timeless Way of Building, from 1979. And what this is about is you know, architecture can really make or break your society. It's really basic to sociology and things like that, is where your living space can really affect your society. It actually determines your society in many ways. So that's what this is. This whole series of books by Christopher Alexander is about, the patterns that are successful, that have been successful throughout history, versus the patterns that have not been successful. This is from Patterns Which Are Alive, the chapter Patterns Which Are Alive. There is a myth, sometimes widespread, that a person need only do inner work in order to be alive like this, that a man is entirely responsible for his own problems, and that to cure himself, he need only change himself. This teaching has some value, since it is so easy for a man to imagine that his problems are caused by others, but it is a one-sided and mistaken view, which also maintains the arrogance of the belief that the individual is self-sufficient and not dependent in any essential way on his surroundings. The fact is, a person is so far formed by his surroundings that his state of harmony depends entirely on his harmony with his surroundings. Some kinds of physical and social circumstances help a person come to life. Others make it very difficult. For instance, in some towns, the pattern of relationships between workplaces and families helps us to come to life. Workshops mix with houses. Children run around the places where the work is going on. The members of the family help in the work. The family may possibly eat lunch together or eat lunch together with the people who are working there. The fact that family and play are part of one continuous stream helps nourish everyone. Children see how work happens. They learn what it is that makes the adult world function. They get an overall coherent view of things, Men are able to connect the possibility of play and laughter and attention to children without having to separate them sharply in their minds from work. Men and women are able to work and to pay attention to their families more or less equally as they wish to. Love and work are connected, able to be one, understood, and felt as coherent by the people who are living there. In other towns where work and family are physically separate, people are harassed by inner conflicts with which they can't escape. A man wants to live in his work and he wants to be close to his family, but in a town where work and family are physically separate, he is forced to make impossible choices among these desires. He is exposed to the greatest emotional pressure from his family. At that moment when he is most tired, when he just comes home from work, he is confused by a subtle identification of his wife and children with leisure, weekends, and hence not the daily stuff of life. A woman wants to be a loving woman, sustaining her children and also to take part in the outer business of the world, to have relationships with what's going on. But in a town where work and family are completely separate, she is forced to make another impossible choice. She either has to become a stereotyped housewife or a stereotyped masculine working woman. The possibility of both realizing her feminine nature and also having a place in the world beyond her family is all but lost to her. A young boy wants to be close to his family and to understand the workings of the world and to explore them. But in a town where work and family are separated, he too is forced to make impossible choices. He has to choose to be either loving to his family or to be a truant who can experience the world. There's no way he can reconcile his two opposing needs, and he is likely to end up either as a juvenile delinquent who has torn himself entirely from his family's love, or as a child who clings too tightly to his mother's skirts. All right, so back in the 60s and 70s, they had what was called satellite cities, and this is basically what the Disneyland model, where you have separate work and banking, financial, everything is separated, and you have to drive everywhere. And so that's a lot of the problems they were having, is that model was thought to be the way to go. And it was, of course, promoted by the auto industry, for one thing. But they really, architects really thought that this was the way to go. But no, we would need small family farms that, link to one another in a confederation more type of system, like Rojava or the Zapatista area of Chiapas, and those areas, I think, are the future. And so that's kind of what the abolitionists are getting at. And I'm coming at this from a completely, my own, from a permaculture type of area. Thanks for listening to your friends. This is, the book is Solidarity with Children by Madeline Lane McKinney. Solidarity with Children. I believe she is also a professor at the U of O. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
But my question was more because I really think it's a very powerful, your argument of trying to also disentangle motherhood or mother as a noun from mothering as a verb. Right? I really, if you could speak a little bit more about how you got to that, and if you would like to also connect it, because you end your book through a kind of utopian framework, right? Or trying to understand, right, like child liberation in relation to utopian thinking, utopian practice, right? So I'm wondering if you'd like to say something about that. I just think that also thinking, right, mothering instead of mother, or right, how you're mothering against motherhood, how you see yourself in that tradition, and how you articulate that.
That's a lot, but I'm going to try to think about a part of it at least. The institution of motherhood is like something like historically white bourgeois women had access to and no one else. Okay. And so there's like clearly a historic problem that carries over. With what motherhood as an institution looks like. I was really interested in the question of mothering. And when I became a mother, I was the only, there's one other mother I know. really isolating. And to be a mother already is really isolating. And to be rendered mother in this way, it's based on expectations of non-reciprocity, of your labor being actually love, right? It's an atomizing, frustrating positionality, right? So I was very curious about thinking in relation to this theorist, Sophie Lewis. Some of you might know her work, Full Surrogacy Now. Her argument is for an abolition of motherhood through full surrogacy, that we're all gestating each other and thinking this way. I wanted to think about it from the other end, that like, why do we have to get rid of mothering? There's so much that I learned from mothering. The problem is that I'm alone in it. Asking questions like, what would it mean to collectivize mothering? Would it even be mothering if it had a collective practice? So those are kind of the questions that work in that chapter. In terms of the utopian project, I really love this idea from Octavia Butler that science fiction, which I compare my book to at the end, as a kind of speculative thought experiment, that science fiction is, the responsibility of science fiction is to parent our future. And I appreciate that idea, a responsibility that we have for the future, regardless of whether we have children or not. But I rarely, I mean, we really have access to that kind of framework, right? When we talk about the future, it's so often packaged as like, but my grandchildren, right, or my children, we can't think about intergenerationality without that kind of, again, like ownership or lineage attached to it. So what would it mean to have a relationship to children and their future? Just as comrades, I guess, is I guess the question of that last chapter. I'm fumbling. I think I didn't do a good job.
No,
sorry.
No, and I wanted also to have space for people.
Love to hear other
questions. Someone has or would like to respond. Maya.
Hi, Madeline, thank you so much for your talk. I appreciate it a lot. Especially right now, I'm in the philosophy department. I'm a grad student. And I'm teaching existentialism right now, which I think is absolutely a joy because I get to engage with students as persons primarily as opposed to students. And so I'm wondering specifically about this question of trans childhood that our country as well as the UK is grappling with in a certain respect, and a lot of gender ideology criticisms about well, the Abigail Schreier stuff of, oh, kids will regret this decision, or if you let kids transition, then what if they regret it? And I'm wondering about this general antipathy or worry we have about people regretting things, especially children. Like, I'm wondering if you've thought about why we seem to want to save individuals, younger individuals, from the possibility of regret. Because it seems to me that regret is really useful to go through. It's really important to go through.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why, just like how you might think about regret in relation to the liberation of children, like being able to go down a path and then decide it was the wrong one, or detransition, right? So just like, in general, how have y'all, as parents and not a parent, like, yeah, how do you teach someone how to regret? And is that something that you think is useful or important to be thinking about now?
That's such a wonderful question. First off, I think like Jules Gill Peterson's written about like the transgender child and the myth of plasticity, this idea, right? I would point anyone to look at regarding this issue specifically around trans children, right? But I think the broader question you're asking around regret has to do with like an aversion to transformation. Yeah, the idea that to undergo transition is going to achieve some kind of permanence, right, is also the myth of adulthood, right? That it's some magical thing one achieves at a certain age, and then you're just flatlining as an adult, right? Whereas childhood, like one of the wonderful things about it is that we actually can see and think about transformation and growth in these things. I think a lot of the book is looking at, key to child liberation is the abolition of adulthood, right? This whole idea that point of permanence can be achieved of non-transformation and things like that, right? And I was really interested in the Latin root of adolescence. Adolescere is to grow, to mature, right? To transform. And this idea that, like, maybe wouldn't it be great if, like, we just we're all adolescents, like, forever, right? And isn't that actually what we are, hopefully? Like, that we keep failing and learning, and maybe we have regrets, but, like, we keep moving, we keep building on insights, on our critical capacity, on our collective power, right? So much of adulthood is structured around, like, the impossibility of those things. Right. So I guess that's the short end of how I would answer that question. But do others have thoughts on this?
I mean, one thing I would think about is, I mean, I think, you know, like, trying to reframe the urge to protect. I mean, so, yeah, like, I have a very strong urge to protect my child, you know, like, I would sort of, like, if I could, and I didn't think it'd be, like, too much, I'd, like, follow him around, you know, be like, no, don't hit your head there, right? But you're gonna hit your head. No, I'm not. And then people, right, you know, so you're like, why, you know, but also, like, the point, I think we think, like, okay, we should prevent mistakes from happening, which I think is also this idea of preventing regret, right? And I think what we really should focus on is, you know, sort of building the strength and the comfort to, you know, to be resilient, right? Which is also, I think, a parenting conflict I have with my own parents versus, you know, our mode of parenting, which is the sort of, like, idea that, like, you know, like, oh, you've got to be tough because the world is tough, so you'll be tough, so then they'll know that, and, like, I mean, the world's going to be tough. Like, they're not going to, like, my child's not going to fail to notice that everything doesn't go his way outside of the house. That doesn't mean that we can't, like, make things comfortable and safe for him in the house, right? Like, just because we make things safe for him in the house doesn't mean he's, like, not going to survive the world. I feel this is, like, a very weird sort of idea people have. So I feel like if we could think of protecting more as, like, sort of creating sort of a safe space to return to reflect in, and create the ability to think about and address regret and change and do things like that. Like, we can, like, sort of foster that ability. We are more protective than if we're just sort of trying to stop things from happening always, you know. Yeah. But I feel like, you know, it would be a matter, it should be a matter of helping people who are parenting to, like, redirect those urges. I don't think the urge to protect someone is not a bad thing, right? But you need that sort of critical reflection on what really protects people in sort of the long run, right? Which is that resilience rather than just stopping the bad thing from happening at all times. So I want to do that too. I really do.
I read somewhere when I was pregnant, I was reading a bunch of parenting books. And one of them said, don't do everything from your child for your child because you'll steal their confidence. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I've just been thinking about that since. And this kind of relationship that, I mean, my daughter is only 10 months, so, you know, this is like newbie talk right here. but there's this constant thing where she's trying to test limits, and it's just like you were saying, Kamisha, trying to create, like, a, you know, a safe environment, but for her to fall over and for her to mess up and to try things out and to, yeah, like, hopefully learn on her own, but that takes a lot of the time I have to I have to, like, fix my own face and my own reaction. Like, so that she can have her reaction. Like, she can fall over and then tell me if she's hurt or scared or... as opposed to me informing her about how she feels.
Right.
And I think that, I don't know, I think like, you know, this is like a new way of parenting in some ways, because that's not how I was, you know, brought up. But I do think that there's an understanding now that that is how confidence in oneself and is cultivated. And I think, again, regret, the one other thing was, they said, let your kids tell you when they want something, and so that when they don't get it, they can also tell you that they're disappointed. And, like, wanting things and not getting them, I mean, that's so basic, but it's, that is the grounds for intimacy, and life is full of disappointment, but to not let yourself want things, you know, nothing's gonna happen. And so that's what I would hope, and to want to figure out who you are and to feel good in your body and in your life, like that's at stake here, right, in your question.
Mm-hmm. And just to say something clear, because I can't, but to me, I love the question, Maya, because it's also, like, I think also asking us, like, where does the misery come from? And it's actually, like, well, trans children, intersex children, and any children, they're not miserable because of who they are. They're miserable because they're fucked by transphobic capitalism, who does, like, right? It's, like, it's what has made life unlivable, right? And I think what a lot of the encampment reveals and, like, trans autonomy reveals is that not only is this bullshit, but it actually doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
Right. So it's in itself, right, a contestation of the world. It is literally a contestation of the metaphysics of the world. And I think people, that is what really, really triggers people. But it's like, we have all been brainwashed that this is all, right, like this could be different, right? We could live communally in a different way that reflects our values. And so that's why the targets have to be that, right? So in many ways, yes.
I guess this is less of a, like, theoretical question, honestly, for all three of you, and more of a, like, practical question. I don't have kids, but I have been around kids for an extremely long amount of time. And I feel like there's a weird balance to constantly navigate between, like, adult patience and child learning, and, like, kind of related to what you were talking about, this sort of, like, you want your kid to explore and build confidence to learn things, and also you're late to the doctor's appointment, and it's not the time for your kid to learn how to put their jacket on, and, like, you know, all of those things. And I feel like I'm really interested in your opinions and, like, thoughts on that sort of having to take away some autonomy at some point, because you're like, hey, bestie, we have waited 6 months for this doctor's appointment. We gotta go.
Yeah.
And sorry, it is, yes, you should learn. Like, I want you to be able to put your jacket on, but also right now is, like, really not the time. And similarly, this idea of, like, teaching kids about autonomy and then it coming back to bite you in the ass because a kid is like, my body, my choice, I don't want to wear a shirt. And you're like, so true. Also, you can't go to school without a shirt. And I guess just, like, how practically you guys navigate, maybe harder at a 10, like 10 months is a little bit different because they're not yet at the stage of, like, I want to put my jacket on by myself, but they are at the, I have, my time is for me, and you want me to do something else, I'll start screaming. Yeah, so just, I guess, like, how you guys navigate the patience aspect of, and at what point are you like, actually, yes and no?
That's a great question. So, child, like, if you go online or something like this, comments about this book will say either that I'm a pedophile, a groomer, or, which these are fascist tactics, but also, child liberation, that was like, eating candy all day.
Right.
And shitting all over and being unclean and unsafe. Right? It must mean that. It must mean, you know, it must mean, you know, children of the corn or, you know, something like this, right? Like, you're deeply dystopian imaginary at work in this idea of child liberation. And I think part of this has to do with this word. I'm going to not answer the question about patience and think about the concept of autonomy in your question, right? Because we do talk, we do think about these things in terms of autonomy. I think a better way around it is to think about dependency, right? Like, none of us are autonomous, actually. Like, we should be able to be, we should all be able to be self-determining and things like this, right? But like, the reality is even adults are not not independent, right? We all depend on each other, right? And so I think thinking about teaching children the way in which like adults depend on each other, that they depend on us, right? And sometimes that they do depend on us to know things about safety, right? To know things about risk, right? That they haven't encountered yet, right? And that's not about wisdom or maturity, that's just about experience, right? Like, adults have more experience than children, for better and most of the time for worse, right? So how do we take responsibility for that experience, and also to create relationships that are about honoring our dependency on each other, rather than, I think, as much as I like the idea that like we can be autonomous, just I think part of that needs to really be troubled in our imagination. Patience. I have an incredibly chill kid who's right there.
There's been a kid.
They look like a college student at this point.
Super cool.
And I appreciate how chill they are. Sorry to point to you. And they have more patience for me than I probably have to extend for them in a lot of ways, to get back to the dependent thing. But a lot of the time, parenting is super frustrating. That age was the hardest for me because there wasn't language yet. And I felt a huge sense of relief once like language came into the picture, right? So then there was some negotiating around things like that, right? But
that's the age when you still can, without harming the child, physically place them somewhere you need them if necessary, even with struggle. At a certain age, like if there's enough struggle, like the amount of force you have to use to like counter the struggle would actually be harmful. And so then you really have to hope that your child doesn't quite realize that they could really protest to a level that it could actually not happen, like school. I think patience is like a huge. I guess I feel like I sort of try to remember that a lot of things are not that important to me, so that when it's really that important to me, I like go all in on it. Which, yeah, but like you, I feel like it's really important to like pick your battles. Like if something is very, very important, then you're gonna just like really just take all the time you need to make it happen and use, you know, all the sort of persuasive power you can possibly muster. But I feel like a lot of the time, I just like letting it go. We're chronically late to school, and it is always for like silly reasons, like, you know, like we're in the kitchen and it's like morning, and then like, and I like cut some watermelon, and then like my child sees the watermelon and he just recently has like been into cutting watermelon, which is also very stressful for me, but he let me do it. But he was like, I need to cut that watermelon now. I'm like, what? We need to leave the house. He's like, I gotta cut this watermelon. Are you like, what? Like, we're in the process of leaving the house, and so you gotta cut a watermelon? Like, really? You really have to do this like right now? But you know, he doesn't like to be late. But we're late a lot, and so so I just sort of like, okay, well, he's gonna see. And I try to really avoid the, like, I told you so. Like, and now, yeah, he's like, oh, we're late. I'm like, yeah, we can get out of the house as quick as you want to. We'll try again tomorrow, you know? But, you know, so it's trying to not, like, I don't know. I feel like one of the strongest tendencies that I really try to avoid is the sort of, like, I told you so kind of thing. Like, I remember my father, like, we had a bouncy house once for a birthday, and, like, we had some, like, foam stuff, like, outside, but, and my son was, like, you know, jumping off the bouncy house onto the foam thing, and it wasn't that big, right, the, like, sort of, the little blocks, was, and so, like, he was gonna very likely, like, overshoot and, like, you know, whatever, and so my father was like, no, you know, stop doing that, you're gonna get hurt, and then I was like, you're gonna get hurt, and when you do, I'm not gonna come for you, I'm like, okay, that's a little, I will comfort you. Like, yes, you keep doing this, you very well are likely to get hurt, and I will still comfort you, because I'm not, like, what? Like, anyway, so we don't talk to them anymore, but it wasn't that incident in the mall, but it all but, you know, I feel like it's, like, sort of this, I tell him what might happen, and then sometimes it doesn't happen, and then sometimes it does happen, and then when it does happen, I just try to be like, oh, wow, I look like you're hurt, I'm so sorry, or, you know, come have a hug, or whatever, you know, but I feel like it does, you know, I feel like you really need, you have to really reflect, I guess, on, like, what really matters to you and to them, and I think also, we'll see how this works out, right, like, in, like, 10, 20 years. But I think I put a lot of stock in, like, the example, like, how are we being, me and my partner, how are we being in how we treat each other, how we do things in the house, and I believe strongly that that would be more important than what individual discussions that we have with him, or fights we win or lose, or whatever, that, because I felt like, you know, my patience was, like, increased, like, manifold when I had my son, and I think it's because my mother was very patient as a mother, and so I think that for me what happened is I hit that life stage, and her example, like, really kicked in for me, and there was, like, patience that I didn't have before that I really, like, you know, sort of acted. So I put a lot of stock in the sort of example more than the, like, individual battle that we decide to have or not have, or, you know, but. You know, I really want him to brush his teeth twice a day, and it's, you know, I don't care as much about the school on time thing, but the teeth brushing thing, I really, really want to happen, and it's a huge struggle, though. But yeah, it's really hard.
Yeah, I feel like it's just been super interesting to think about, because I feel like for a really long time, I was just teaching kids. I was a preschool teacher, and so I was like, you have rules, and there are 20 of them, and so you can't give each kid this individualized attention to be able to do their own chaotic thing in their own chaotic space, because that's going to then impact the next chaotic child, and suddenly you have 20 kids throwing blocks at each other. But then, like, being around kids who are actively being parented, I feel like it's, you see all of the ways that, like, I feel like patience has been the biggest thing that I've, like, really realized. I'm like, oh, I thought I was a patient person around kids, but Jesus Christ, I'm not.
Yeah.
Because this kid put the same pair of pants to wash 6 times in a row, and you're like, hey, I've just washed some laundry. I've done so much laundry. Why am I doing laundry all the time? And I guess just, like, I don't know. It doesn't feel like something that you actually will just develop as you start to mother. It feels like something that I'm like, at some point I just start twitching, and I'm like, oh. Is the twitching ever going to stop? Is it going to
sleep deprived?
I don't think it was natural, like, in the world for all parents. I really feel like it was very specific to how my mother had been for me, and so how I perceived the role of parent. Like, I don't want to be seen to be feeding into some kind of, like, you know, mothers are saints, and they're all just automatically become saints when they have children, and, you know.
No, I mean, yeah, thinking about what you're talking about with, letting your kids take risks, especially at that time. It's not like you're doing this in isolation. Like, people are watching you. that's a lot of the pressure, is, like, being constantly judged, especially mothers, right? To let your kid trip, to make, you know, to understand an important lesson about gravity, right? You're also, like, putting yourself at social risk all the time.
Make noise in a lecture hall.
making it was deeply relatable. I was a graduate student with a baby, and constantly people were judging me, or I felt judged. They were judging me, but I felt judged for just a noise, right? It's really hard to like block that out in terms of like, yeah, how to manage one's patience. I don't know if that's relatable.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
It seems like you're in a good community, though.
That's what I was gonna bring up, actually, is the honoring the dependency, mm-hmm. and that this would be impossible for me without the community that I have here, and that I've cultivated. I mean, I'm like, so many people have held my child in the last hour and a half.
That's so cool.
And I think part of what in your book on mothering, it's this two-way street where I've become a mother through this person, and that's an interpersonal identity that's forming and evolving, and it's been, I feel also that I've had like gifts from this relationship that where I am not a very I wasn't very decisive, and now I feel like my priorities are just in order in a way that I just didn't experience before. And again, I don't know if it's there, I wouldn't say there's any kind of magic or anything, but seeing someone who is truly dependent on me puts all the things that don't matter in like very bold relief.
Yeah.
And that's a gift. And seeing people show up and allowing them to show up for us, that is another gift of dependency. And the other stuff, I mean, that patience, I don't know. I think it's just trying to know if this time actually matters that they put their jacket on right now, or if you can actually just make it to the car or in the stroller and you throw a blanket on them because maybe the jacket doesn't matter right now. But like, sometimes we get so caught up in the thing that we miss the relationship. We miss what actually matters.
I have to, so like, we're at the end, but I want you to be able to ask your questions. Maybe if you both ask your questions, then Madeline can respond, and we can also, if people want to buy the book, they can do that. You can ask Madeline to sign it if that is your wish. So please, your questions. Do you want to go first?
Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi.
I feel like I notice in this kind of conversation, the view is a lot from the educator or parent perspective, but I'm kind of approaching it from the kid perspective. I was in middle school when March for Our Lives happened, and I've been in the perspective of a kid hearing about the youth industrial, or youth activist industrial complex, kind of firsthand of like, you guys are going to save us, you are going to save us.
Yeah.
And I think I noticed the third person language in kind of it's still feeling separated of like saying, sorry, I'm losing my point a little bit, but saying us adults, us educators versus you children, you students. And so I'm curious about how you, in like practical everyday ways, invite children into that adult space or kind of invite yourself into the adolescent space.
That's a wonderful question.
Can we have a second? So,
yeah.
I was wondering, something was said earlier about this idea that like, the world is tough and so we should treat children accordingly. It doesn't really make a lot of sense that we can provide safe spaces even though not all spaces are safe. And I was curious how, or any thoughts that you had about preparing children for that kind of disconnect of you are liberated in my home but you will not be at school, you are liberated in my home but other people are not interested in your liberation outside of our home. And like how you handle the emotional side of that, of like a kid feeling very safe at home and then being aware that it's inappropriate the way that they're being treated outside of the home because they are empowering you.
Very good questions. I'm going to begin with yours. I do not identify as an adult. And I think my jokes about being an adjunct that's what it's like to be, you're the kid, you're a kid, and I'm interested in the ways that, like, even when you're a supposed adult, like, you're rendered child in all of these different ways, whether because you're an anarchist or, like, just lefter than or poorer than, right, the age at which we can, like, afford to, like, take out a mortgage is, like, increasing by right? And so the terms and conditions of, like, adulthood are inaccessible for, like, more and more of us, right? And so, but I also don't take it on myself to, like, say that I am a child. Like, I recognize that I am in many ways privileged with adult status in this world. So I guess that's, like, the starting point. Another, like, I have a colleague who makes his students call him Doctor. I won't say his last name. There is a lot of pressure on, like, women in the academy to, like, say, I am a doctor. And the only time I ever feel that way is when my partner's parents write a letter for my birthday and it says, Mrs. Kyle McKinley on it, right? Like, then I say, I'm a doctor. But that status, you know, like, yeah, I want to be called Madeline in the classroom, right? So there's just, like, kind of rhetorical positioning, like, that we need to be doing. We need to be thinking at the level of, like, the sentence of phraseology around these things. So I really appreciate your question, how attentive it is to the language issues here. Your question, I mean, is impossible, right? Like, you can only, the household isn't even a retreat space from these things, and you bring in all of these horrors and miseries and conflicts into the household. So I think maybe thinking, I don't use the word safe space. I don't think there are safe spaces. I don't think that houses are, in fact, households are where most of the violence against children takes place. Houses are designed, private households are designed to disappear and erase that reality from the world, right? But to think of, like, households as places of process, of transformation, of bringing in these conflicts and being able to dialogue around them, I think is, like, that's the only thing we can really, really do. So it's kind of an insufficient answer to your wonderful question, but that's, I think, the place I would start.
this, our gentle mirror spin. If we lose, the barbers win. Happy family, one hand clap. Four went done, but none came back.
Flying lead. You better close your eyes. time you'll see the line that's drawn between the good and the bad. See the blind man, yeah, he is shooting at the world. Bullets flying, oh, they're taking toll. You have, and you've not been healed, not been hit by flying lead. You better close your eyes.